All right. We're going to start today. A couple things I just want to mention. Your exam, I have talked with Julie, and yes, you can take it the first hour on Wednesday. So I think that's what you guys as a kind of a class we're wanting to do is just take your test and get it over with. So your exam for the content we're going to be finishing up today is on Wednesday, 11:50 to about 1 in the lower level of the library, just like where we always test, okay? It is on the computer, nothing new. You guys have been testing that way, and the questions are very similar to what you have seen previous. 50 questions, all of that's the same. Okay. What major concerns questions do you have for me? Nothing yet, ask us at the end of the class, right? Maybe?
So your study guide's pretty representative?
Absolutely. Your study guide, the study guide I gave you is very representative of the test. So if you've been filling that out, answering as you go, you are going to be set for Wednesday. Okay? Yes?
I have a question on this chart. It talks about the diagnostics. So if they are falling within these levels, do they or do they not have diabetes? I guess I'm a little confused.
Can we go look A1C? Those are basically the normal, what they want.
Okay, so if they were
up.
Okay,
yes.
Okay, got it.
Very good. Okay. Basically, today what we're going to do is I'm going to go through a PowerPoint, which is kind of uncharacteristic of me, but we're going to do that. We're going to go through the hematologic PowerPoint. You have a copy of that. It is yellow. So we're going to talk through DIC, leukemia, and then as well as stem cell transplants. Then we're going to then move on to HIV and AIDS. And we're basically going to cover that content with a case study. And going through the questions. And again, with the questions, I'll pull out what is important to know for the test. And then we're going to see how far we get with cancer. And we'll talk about that when we get there. Kathy, at some point, is also going to come in today because you're getting close to where we're going to start presentations. And so going to talk about the sign-up sheet, possibly for the presentations. I know where she's going to talk through the annotated bib a little bit. And so that's going to cut into our class time a little bit as well. Okay? But we're going to move as fast as we can. So if at any point I'm talking too fast, or if something doesn't make sense, please make sure you speak up. Okay. So as we talk through hematologic problems, if you look in this chapter, there's a lot more in the chapter than what we're going to talk about. So we just picked out a few of the things that we feel are really important for you to know. One of the things is DIC. You'll hear it abbreviated all the time. If you're working in the hospital, they're not going to say disseminated intravascular coagulation. They're going to say DIC. So you need to understand what that means. It's basically profuse bleeding that results from the depletion of platelets and clotting factors. Okay, but the interesting part about this is disseminated intravascular coagulation, if you think of that name, is that hemorrhage? Or what is that? Clotting. So basically, DIC is a process where our body kicks into a mode where we send out all of our clotting factors and we use them up. Once we don't have any clotting factors, then we can bleed, and we can bleed to death. And DIC can be very much that way, where they can bleed to death in a very short amount of time because they've used up all of their clotting factors. And as we talk through our next slides, we'll see how that can happen. DIC is never alone. A healthy person like you or I are not all of a sudden just going to go into DIC standing here, sitting here. There is going to be an underlying disease, and there is a text in your textbook on table 31-20. It gives you an idea of what some of those disorders could be. Shock, sepsis, OB conditions, HELLP syndrome, placental abruption. Hopefully those sound familiar to you from your OB class. Tissue damage, so extensive burns, trauma, if they've had a massive stroke, severe head injury, transplant rejections. Now again, it's not important for me that you understand what all those could be. There's a lot of things that could cause your body to go into DIC. The important thing is to recognize, number one, recognize that it's happening, and number two, try to figure out what this underlying cause was, because your body's not going to get better until you treat what actually caused the disorder, the DIC. I mean, we can give them blood products and platelets and fresh frozen plasma if we need to, But until we fix the trauma or go take him to surgery to fix a hemorrhage, it's not necessarily going to save the problem or fix the problem. All right, so let's look at what actually happens here. This is also in your textbook, page 687. If you have trouble reading it on your slide, then it's very bad on your slide for those who tried to read it. So basically, one of those causes that we just talked about happen. It leads basically to thrombosis. So it's telling our body that we need to start coagulating, and all those coagulation factors are starting to come together. Okay, so we're starting to have all these clots forming in our blood, okay? The problem with that is if we don't have a massive hemorrhage somewhere, or even if we do, these mini clots that are circulating in our blood aren't gonna fix any problem. All they're gonna do is cause more problems, okay? Because then they start to occlude the vessels that feed our organs. So when we have that happening, we have microvascular thrombosis, okay? You can have delirium, you can have coma, you can have gangrene set in. Any of these that you see, pulmonary issues, they can act like they're having a PE, or they actually can have a pulmonary embolism, can send them into ARDS. All of those things that you could think that would cut off a blood supply and cause an organ fail can happen to your renal system too. They didn't list everything there. That can happen when your blood starts to throw lots of little clots, okay? Lots of problems can happen. But after a while, your body can't keep up with making the fibrin and fibrinogen products to create more, so then we start to bleed because we deplete all of our clotting factors. So then we have circulating fibrin degradation products and consumption of the platelets and coag proteins, and therefore the patient is just going to bleed and almost bleed profusely. How would you think of that when I say someone might be bleeding profusely? What comes to your mind? How would you as the nurse maybe be clued in that this might be happening?
Old wounds could start re-bleeding again.
Wounds, absolutely. If they have any wounds or cuts, scrapes anywhere, they would start bleeding and oozing without being bumped, right? Or the scab picked off. What else? Petechiae, what is that?
That's when you get little red dots.
Right, you have the microvascular ruptures under the skin, so like pinpoint red marks under your skin. Okay, and you can have a lot of them, so much that they actually even start to look like a bruise if they continue to rupture. Pardon me? Right. You can have hemocult blood, so it can come out of your GI tract. Maybe they were in because they had some GERD, some GI ulcers, or some stomach ulcers. They're going to start bleeding profusely as well. Anything that they have is going to start oozing blood. And when I say bleeding profusely, I don't mean it's going to be shooting out of their body, okay? But it's going to start oozing, and they're going to start bleeding. And you're going to apply pressure, and it's not going to stop because there's no clotting factors left in the blood to stop it from bleeding, okay? So those should be your first warning signs that something is going wrong. Here's a picture of that petechiae. Again, doesn't do it justice in black and white, and it's just the start of that. So, signs. We kind of talked about that bleeding with no history or obvious cause. So as we deplete our blood, they're going to get pale. Okay, their skin color is going to change. We're going to start to see petechiae, hemorrhage, in multiple places throughout the body. And some of the interesting part is you may need to turn them to see that, because where there's the most pressure on the tissues is where you're going to see the vessels rupture. So if they're laying on their back, you may need to look at their back to see the petechiae. Initially, it's not going to come where there's not pressure, okay? Purpura, oozing blood, hematomas, those all fall into that blood under the skin. Tachypnea, okay? They're going to start breathing fast. Why? Compensation, our compensatory mechanism. Absolutely, very good. Hemoptysis, what is that? Yep, they're going to be spitting up blood. Orthopnea, so they're not going to take position changes well. Tachycardia, hypotension, that relates with that orthopnea. Okay, again, our compensatory mechanisms there. They may have tarry stools. We may see GI bleeding, abdominal distension, blood in the urine. Okay, what is this? Why would we have vision changes, dizziness, headache, irritability? There's multiple reasons we could see that. Why should those kind of make sense to us? Does anybody have a guess? Absolutely. Very good, because we have less blood, so we're getting less oxygen to our brain. Okay, very good. What else could be a reason for this? Do we only bleed from our neck down? Could the neurological changes we see be from bleeding that's actually occurring within the brain? Yes. Okay. So the neurological changes we see could be either be from lack of blood supply and blood flow, okay, because we're just losing too much and it's not getting up to the brain, or maybe we are bleeding into the brain, okay? So we can't disregard those either. Okay, bone and joint pain. Why would we have bone and joint pain? Our bones don't bleed.
Fluid on your joints.
Good guess. Think about the source of your blood cells. Bone marrow, okay? So is the body trying to stimulate the bone marrow probably to produce more because it's running out as part of our feedback mechanism within our body? It is. So when we talk about leukemia too, you're gonna see some bone and joint pain, but it's because that's the source of our blood products and where they're being made. And so our body is saying, come on, you're not keeping up, we're losing the battle here. And they're working as hard as they can, and that actually can cause some bone and joint pain. All right, weakness, malaise, and fever. They're also going to have some of the thrombotic manifestations. Those first ones we went through were the hemorrhagic, so the ones we see because of bleeding. These are some of the signs we're going to see because of the initial clotting that took place, okay? Result of the platelets or fibrin in the microvessels. So cyanosis, especially if it's to a certain area or extremity, you can have clots that actually block blood flow to fingers, toes, those types of things. So tissue ischemic necrosis, hemorrhagic necrosis, PE and ARDS. PE stands for pulmonary embolism. Okay. If it blocks some of the vessels that feed our gut, we can have a paralytic ileus. If it blocks vessels that lead to our kidneys, we can have kidney failure, acute renal failure, that can set in. Do those make sense to us?
Okay. So we'll see those before we see some of the other clinical ones, because you're saying that that happens with the clotting.
It can, and this whole process really can happen within an hour. So even though, because of the vast amount, that it just floods the body very, very quickly. So even though we may see PE set in, but if they have damage to the kidneys, they may or may not have pain depending on what the cause was specific in that area. So we may, although yes, the answer is yes, we may not truly see the effects of this until after we've seen the bleeding problems. Just because this whole, literally, it needs to be recognized quickly because they can die within an hour of the onset of DIC. They will bleed that profusely. Has anybody seen DIC at all? Thank goodness. All right, so how do we diagnose it? If we suspect it, it's always safe to draw coagulation studies. These should make sense to us, because if it's a coagulation problem, that's what we're gonna draw. We're gonna draw our PT, PTT, APTT, thrombin time. The newest one our book doesn't talk about, but we need to talk about, because that's what you see in practice, is anti-XA. Okay, remember that clotting factor? How many of you have been doing that at clinicals or at preceptorships? Been looking at some of those types of labs? Okay. We're going to look at platelets. Obviously, these are all going to be low. We're going to have increased bleeding time. Fibrinogen is going to be low. Platelets low. Fibrin split products are going to be low. What's a D-dimer?
There's a clot.
Correct. It tells us there are clots in the blood, but that's all it does. It doesn't tell us where. Okay, we still have to figure that out. Just it tells us there's clots somewhere. Factor SAs, again, that's all related to clotting, antithrombin 3, protein S and C. You don't need to remember these odd ones. Okay, just know we're going to be looking at clotting factors, platelets, fibrin, those are the main ones, to tell that the bleeding is going on. Okay.
Would they do like CT or anything to figure out what, where a bleed would be?
Yes, they probably would. They might do that later. If we know, they cannot necessarily diagnose DIC from just a CT scan. It has to be off the low counts from the blood. But they would absolutely, you're exactly right, need to figure out if there, where and if there is a hemorrhage going on. And hopefully by our thorough nursing assessment, right, that we're going to do, we could give them a clue that, oh, they're confused and they're lethargic. We really, and that's a change for them. We probably should do a head CT. Or their abdomen is a lot more bloated than what it was before. I'm concerned, okay, that there may be a bleed there. I don't hear any bowel sounds, that type of thing. So hopefully we could guide them a little bit, but you're absolutely right. Okay, survival depends on quick recognition. And again, with this, always remember, is there a quick fix for DIC, do you think? No, not really. ABCs. If you have a test question about DIC and priority of care, there is no one medication we're going to give that's going to fix this, okay? We're going to do ABC, so airway, breathing, circulation. So make sure they have an airway, put on oxygen if we can, because the blood they have is going to get thinner if they're bleeding out, right? And circulation, right? If they're losing blood, we're going to want to give blood, but on most floors, where this is going to occur, do they have immediate access to blood? How many of you had gone through the process of having to hang blood for your patient? Okay. Does it take a little bit to get the blood you need? Absolutely it does. So again, we're going to start with normal saline or LR immediately, okay, to give them volume expansion. And then as we get the blood products, then we will hang those platelets, all of that. Fix our cause. They're going to continue to bleed until we fix our cause. All right, this diagram is also in your textbook. It's on page 689. And it kind of just talks through exactly what we talked about. We have there just various causes here, okay, that come down to treatment. And we're going to basically treat the same way after we treat the cause. Okay, if they're still, before they start bleeding, if there's just some clots in the vessels, we can give heparin, okay? Although depending on where they're at in the cycle, we may want to give that cautiously because we know they're already going to be at a bleeding risk from using those up, okay? After the consumption of platelets, fibrinogen, that's what we're going to want to give. You'll see the treatment options over here to the left. They really are no longer using Zygris. FDA has pulled that from the market, so you're not necessarily going to see that used anymore. The side effects were actually more and more costly to the patients when they used it. Give blood, RBC, and platelet transfusion. And if they do have acute renal failure, they may be on dialysis for a short time. Again, acute renal failure means the dialysis can actually be beneficial to them and the kidneys can regenerate. That doesn't mean they need dialysis the rest of their life. That means they need dialysis just to let their kidneys heal so they can get, hopefully, regain normal function again. All right, so some of the nursing diagnosis. As we think about all the things that are going on in the body, ineffective peripheral tissue perfusion. If we don't have blood to circulate, we're not going to get to the tissues. Okay, acute pain. We talked about that. Why would they have pain? Not oxygen. Very good. We're not getting oxygen to the tissues. Okay, decreased cardiac output from the hemorrhaging. Yep, the bleeding. And anxiety. Absolutely. If you're bleeding out, you're going to be a little bit anxious, right? Absolutely. So basically, detect early the signs and symptoms, recognize it. Do not be afraid to order lab work or to make sure that someone is aware that you're concerned that this might be going on. Fix your cause. That's one of the main things. Oxygen, replace lost blood, clotting factors, and fibrin. Okay? But until we get the blood up, we need to start normal saline. Okay, because we need volume in until we get that. Okay, any questions about DIC? I saw it once in Orange City when I was working in OB, and it was a high-risk patient, and she had HELLP syndrome. And we were, she was early. She wasn't necessarily ready to deliver, but things were progressing quickly. And we ended up, she delivered the baby there. The baby, believe it or not, was healthy and did okay. And mom, we actually saved. They caught it quick enough. There was enough of nurses back there that they had fluid and that it was a good day to fly. Thank goodness for the helicopter. And they got it on their way right away. Just because of her HELLP syndrome anyway, they were going to want to transfer mom and babe immediately after the delivery. And so it worked out. They did end up saving mom, and that doesn't happen a whole lot, especially in the rural hospitals. So that was a great thing. Yes?
On the diagnostics for fibrinogen platelets, would those be, like, depending on where they are in the, so would they be up, increased initially, and then do you
absolutely.
Get,
yep.
Do, if it all happens in an hour, then
Correct. All right. Let's talk about leukemia. What does anybody know about leukemia? Did anybody care for a patient who had leukemia when they were on oncology? Yes. What do you know about leukemia?
That it causes a lot of bone pain.
A lot of bone pain. And what? And do you know why
it causes bone pain? Because it can't take in the bone marrow.
Absolutely. Leukemia is a cancer in the bone marrow and in the blood. Okay. And so we see it, and it's so. Is it just? Does it kind of travel throughout the whole body then, and cause a lot of systemic effects? Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely, it does. Leukemia can occur in all age groups. There's different kind. There's myelocytic leukemia and lymphocytic leukemia, and we'll talk about those in the next slides. But it affects the bone marrow, the lymph system, and basically the spleen. There's really no single causative factor, and we're going to cover oncology later, hopefully yet today. And so, as we'll see with most of the cancers, there's multiple things that could cause the cancer to form, and that's not any different with leukemia. There can be abnormal genes that can be related to different chemical exposure or radiation. There are even viruses that can change the makeup of different cells, and therefore can cause cancers to occur. So it's kind of scary and overwhelming when you think of it. This is just a picture of cellulitis on a lady. This is also in your textbook. And why would a lady have cellulitis if we're talking about leukemia? Can't absolutely be from radiation. What's another thought? Why could they have cellulitis? Let's think about our blood. White blood cells. So what was going to happen to our white blood cells?
Decreased.
We're going to talk a lot about neutropenia. So we're going to be using up probably our lymphocytes. Acute lymphocytic leukemia is one of them. And I'll turn to the next page and we can talk about it a little bit. But as we use up our immune system, our white blood cells, for different things, it's going to lose its ability to fight off various infections. So the patients are going to be neutropenic. They're going to be they're going to be prone, basically, to different types of infections. Cellulitis is one of them. There is a table in your textbook on page 695 that talks about the various forms of leukemia. You do not need to know each one of these, okay? AML and ALL are the two that we're going to basically focus on and talk about. AML occurs most commonly in older adults, and ALL can be seen usually first diagnosed in children, but it also then can carry on and is diagnosed in some older adults as well. So as we think about leukemia in general, it's affecting our white blood cells, okay? Mostly, that's how we're gonna see these symptoms. So let's talk about these and try to make sense of why they occur, because then you'll remember them, okay? So with AML, myelocytic or myelogenic leukemia. Okay, myeloblasts basically are part of our what?
What do you remember about myeloblasts?
Yep, they work with muscles. They're part of the white blood cell count, and they actually, as they grow out of control, we start to see more signs. It can be with some muscle problems, but we're also going to see a lot of the same signs as we're going to see with ALL, with infection, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia. We're going to see a lower white cell count because it is still affected in the bone marrow. But you are going to see more fatigue, weakness, headache. Why would you have a mouth sores?
Related to infection.
Okay, very good. Is our mouth highly prone to infectious? I mean, do we put a lot of things in our mouth?
Yes.
Okay, is it highly vascular too? Yes. Can it get dry from breathing, from sleeping? Okay, there's so many things that come in and out of our mouth. It can be very prone. Okay, anemia. Okay, decrease in red blood cells. Why would we have anemia? Exactly. Okay, our bone marrow isn't working effectively, so we're not having a good white red blood cell count. Okay, fever. Why might they have a fever? It's your body's response, and that's normally what we see when we have a lot of white blood cells going to the area, right? Okay, so if we have low white cells, why would we have a fever? Very good. Our body's going to go in a hypermetabolic state to try to still kill off what's going on. It's another compensatory mechanism that our body is going to be using to try to help fight as much as we can. Okay, there's going to be infection. Okay, like we saw with the cellulitis, there's going to be an what we can think of as opportunistic infections that are going to occur. Okay, the white blood cell count is initially going to be high, but then we're going to see more and more of our immature white cells circulating in the blood, right? We talked about that a little bit with our shift to the left when we were talking about labs. Okay, with the neutrophils, or shift to the left. And initially, we're going to send everything out to try to fight. And then what happens when we don't have anything left to send out that's mature? We're going to send out the babies. Okay, so initially the white count is going to be high, but as this continues to progress, the white cell count is going to just drop quite rapidly. Okay, sternal tenderness, bone pain, we kind of talked about that already because that's where our bone marrow is produced. Okay, the other one that you're going to see with this that I'd like you to put on or write on your slide is decreased platelets. And you should have it on your slides, I think, right? Decreased platelets, known as thrombocytopenia. So if they have decreased platelets, what are they going to be at risk for? Bleeding. Okay. With ALL, we're going to see more CNS changes, nausea and vomiting, lethargy, cranial nerve dysfunction, meningeal infiltration. Okay. Generalized lymphadenopathy, what is that? What does it sound like?
All over.
Yeah. Lymph nodes, the lymph system is overrun with extra fluid, and so you have swollen lymph nodes and lymph glands throughout the body. I must not have
saved my complete one. The one you have is complete.
So we'll talk about that. So diagnostic studies. How do we diagnose leukemia? What are some of the blood studies? You have it right on your sheet. WBCs, what have we just talked about that's going to help us? So WBCs, platelets, right? We're going to look at platelets. We're going to look at red blood cells. Okay, and we're anticipating all of those will be
low.
Yep, low. bone marrow biopsy.
Why would we do that?
See what you're dealing with?
Yeah, isn't this kind of the source of our problem? Is in our bone marrow? So getting a bone marrow biopsy would be very important to do because we could figure out for sure if this is a source of our problem. I know some of you have actually seen a bone marrow biopsy. What can you tell us about that procedure?
Has anyone?
It's like a huge needle and then like...
Say it really loud.
They stick a huge needle inside the bone and then pull a bunch of...
What bone?
Well, the hip.
Usually it's the iliac crest.
Yeah.
So the patient lays on what position?
On their side.
They can lay on their side or they can lay prone, depending on the patient and what's going on. Very good. Do they numb them first? Yeah.
No.
And it's not like necessarily going in and drawing blood, right, Morgan? Because is it hard to get into the core of that bone?
Yeah.
It almost, from the ones I've seen, and Kathy can probably attest to that too, it's not a simple, easy process. You have to get into that bone with a coring type needle. And so they're literally pressing with all their might on the patient's hip.
Like twisted it?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yep. And then they withdraw the bone marrow. What does it look like? Did you get to see what it looked like? It's like just a spongy reddish yellow piece. It's basically what it looks like.
And it comes out in like a full core, like staying connected.
Yeah, it doesn't spread out. It's not like a liquid. It's a thick piece that they pull out. So they're going to take a bone marrow biopsy to do that, to look at the bone, to look and truly diagnose ALL or any type of leukemia. They might do a lumbar puncture. Why would they do a lumbar puncture? Could. They could look for infection. Again, it's ruling out. We're going to rule out what else could be going on. Also, it's useful for any CNS changes. It'll check the cells in the lymph fluid. In the... spinal fluid, excuse me, not the lymph fluid, in the spinal fluid, to make sure that there are no abnormal cells there as well. Okay, and they may do a CT scan as well. Why would they do that? To look for any leukemic cells outside of the blood and the bone marrow. They can look for any with a high density CT scans, they can look for those types of irregularities. Okay. I'm going to leave this here because we're going to talk about some of this collaborative care. This obviously wasn't my most updated PowerPoint that is on the screen. So our collaborative care, our main goal is
remission.
Does it ever truly go away? Not really. I like that answer. Okay, not really. It goes into remission. And what does that mean? Correct. And it has to be cancer-free for how long to actually say your cancer is gone? Yes. I'm not sure if it's different for leukemia, but yes, generally they say at least 5 years. Okay. So basically the goal for them, especially initially, is remission. We want to get on top of the cancer cells and the abnormalities within the white blood cell count. There are different things we can do to help them. If the white blood cell count is high, they can do a thing called leukapheresis. Okay, you've heard of plasmapheresis, haven't you? Have you heard of that? So what would leukapheresis mean?
Just taking out the white or the leukocytes.
Right. Taking out the white blood cells that are abnormal, okay, and removing them from the blood to decrease the white blood cell count. So what will be circulating will be more effective.
So would this happen before the white blood cell count decreased then?
Correct, because neutropenia is a concern.
Okay.
Correct. You're absolutely right. Because initially the body is going to send out as much as they can, but it might not be mature, and it's not necessarily going to be ones that are going to fight effectively. They're just going to make the blood thicker and not work as well as it needs to. Okay, for neutropenia, for our collaborative care, what are we going to need to do for someone who's neutropenic? Neutropenic precautions. Absolutely. And what does that mean? On our cancer slides, we'll talk a little bit more about neutropenic precautions. Did anybody care for anyone that was under neutropenic precautions? What did you see? What stood out different to you than normal precautions?
No fresh flowers.
Yeah, why? Who doesn't want fresh flowers?
Yeah.
Why? There's a reason.
Bacteria and cells, it's gross.
Correct. The bacteria can grow, and they like those types of things. Okay, no fresh flowers in the room. What else?
They can't have much visitors.
Very good. They restrict visitors, especially if they're sick, they can't have any. Even visitors that go in, should they gown, mask, glove, those things? Okay. What about foods they eat?
No fresh fruits.
Yeah, no fresh fruits or vegetables. Again, why?
Same reason.
Even though they taste good and they have a lot of nutrient value, they also can bring in and carry a lot of bacteria with them. So it's different than reverse isolation, right? It adds a few more steps onto there that you need to make sure that you're thinking about for those patients, because they don't have the white cells to fight off anything. Okay? Let's talk a little bit about, we're also neutropenia. I want to take another step back. Another thought. So how are we going to, if you know they have a low white cell count, how are you going to monitor for infection on these patients? What are you going to do? Temperature. Frequently, right? At least every 4 hours. And are you going to wait till it gets up to 102 or 103? No. Will it ever get that high?
Could.
It could, but they are going to be very sick. Okay, if it would get that high. A temperature even of 100.6 or 7, they consider a pretty high fever with someone who's neutropenic. Because the body doesn't have its normal fighting defenses to create a fever high enough to continue to fight things off. So even a low-grade fever for someone who's neutropenic can be a big problem. Or can be an indicator of a big problem that's going on in the body. Okay? Thrombocytopenia. Obviously, we need to look for signs and symptoms of hemorrhage. And we just kind of went over those in the last slides. For treatment of chemotherapy, we're going to look at some drugs. Or for treatment of leukemia, excuse me, we're going to use chemotherapy. Although that can work, what else can it add to make things worse for that patient? Neutropenia, right? Chemotherapy itself can actually kill white cells. And the leukemia has a low white cell count. So we have to be very cautious with some of these patients. The good news is there are so many advances in chemotherapy that there's different drugs they can use now. So the outlook and prognosis is a lot better. Okay. If someone has a low white count, there is a medication we can give, and it is on your slide. Neupogen. Has anybody given it? Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Neupogen, what does it do? It tells you right on the slide. It stimulates your bone marrow to increase your neutrophils. So it causes your bone marrow to try to become effective again and to produce more.
Apparently it hurts less if you warm it up first.
You have given it. Wonderful. So tell us about the process, because it's not like a simple shot, right?
It's kind of fun. It's got its own like little, you know, that when you after you give it, you just push it and it covers it.
And it covers it. Is it a blood product? Did you have to get it from lab, or where did they have it?
I was in the ER following a nurse, so like someone who came in to get it. So
oh, okay. Okay. Generally, again, it isn't something they're going to keep in Pyxis. They have to get Neupogen from the lab. It has to be type in cross matched, and it has to be matched to that patient. Okay, so the body doesn't react to it. So it's a little bit of a process. But even in an outpatient clinic, or when I was working in the local hospital in the ER, we'd have patients come in all the time for their G-CSF and their Neupogen shots, just so they could avoid neutropenia from setting in. Okay, the other one I have there, meds that they might see is corticosteroids. Why would we use corticosteroid? Yep, to decrease inflammation. And although that's going to be a really good thing, what is the bad side to that, if someone with leukemia? Suppresses the immune system. Okay, so they're going to use those sparingly. But that is an option for them. Other collaborative care in the next slide, we're going to talk about radiation. And again, we'll talk about chemo, radiation, and all of these a little more in depth when we talk about cancer. But what is radiation? Absolutely. It's really basically a very intense x-ray that can be targeted anymore. They're very precise, pinpoint precise. It can be external or internal radiation, and basically it just targets those cells, those cancer cells, and therefore tries to eradicate them or get rid of them the best that it can. The goal, again, is to decrease the number of cancer cells so the body can overcome it. Your body has a little bit of a natural fighting ability. And a lot of times we'll have more than one route. They may do chemo and radiation. They're not just going to do one form. They're going to do multiple sources to try to kill the leukemia or whatever type of cancer there is. The other thing that we're going to talk about a little more in depth here pretty soon is hematopoietic stem cell transplant. What is that? Have you talked about stem cells in any of your other classes? I'm assuming you probably have. Briefly, yes. Ask me on another day and I might remember more, right?
Okay. The kind of thing where you talk about when someone gets a transplant from like someone that's like related to them?
Correct. That is a different... When you're talking about that, you're talking about the different types of like allogenic, syngenic, the different type of it's related or kin or yourself, right? This is a blood stem cell transplant. Hemato... your blood, right? Hematopoietic blood or stem cell transplant, meaning they're basically, we're going to take the stem cells, we're going to try to eradicate the old blood cells, and we're going to transplant in new stem cells from the blood. There's different ways we can get that, and we'll talk about that here in just a little bit, to actually try to help the body cure itself of cancer. The goal is total elimination of the leukemic cells with attempts stem cell transplant. This is something that has gotten a lot more common, especially in the larger facilities. You're going to see stem cell transplants taking place. We've actually taken care of, I have an OB moms who have come in who have wanted to save stem cells from their embryonic stem cells from their baby, and they're freezing them and they're banking them because of different risks. They've had a family genetic history of certain diseases. So they're saving their stem cells. So it's pretty cool. And you guys will see a lot more than that, I'm sure, in the next few years. Okay. When someone has leukemia, we need to focus on physical and psychosocial needs, maximize their physical functioning, provide hope, encourage discussion of quality of life issues. What other things might you need to think about? Is their prognosis good?
Depends.
And good answer. Isn't that always about right? Why would it depend?
It depends on how early you catch it and what kind of disease.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It depends. It also depends on how well their body responded to the treatment. Okay? So there are many different things to think about. Quality of life and hope, right, are things we want to help encourage that person to have the best they can throughout their process. Okay? Stay in charge with them with the latest research. Offer them, if you know they're wherever you're working, if they have clinical trials, offer them the option if they're interested in taking or being part of those clinical trials. But again, it's their option. Remember, we just provide the information and they have to make their decisions on their treatment. Okay, and this next slide we kind of talked through as we went through the slides. What are some nursing diagnoses we may see with leukemia after what we've talked about? Risk for infection. Big one that should stick out right on top. What else?
Fatigue.
Very good. One more.
Acute pain.
Very good. Acute pain.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions about leukemia? All right, let's talk a little bit about the stem cell transplant. That's the last part of these slides. I went into it just because hopefully you'll see more of it and be more comfortable just understanding what that process is all about. Okay? Hematopoietic stands for the blood cell production. Okay, so we're looking at actually the blood cells, having the stem cells turn into cells within the blood itself. It used to be termed, if you've heard, bone marrow transplant. Okay, they're sometimes now hematopoietic stem cell transplant. They're used one and the same types of terms. They're now, with the latest technology, they can do peripheral stem cell transplants. We do have some stem cells in our peripheral circulation that they have discovered. They're more mature than the ones obviously in our bone marrow because they've been released out, but they have found a way to harvest those and use those as well, which is something new within the last few years. Because we have this, it allows for higher doses of treatment. If they fail to respond to standard doses of chemo or radiation because of the number of cells that are killed, they can possibly have a transplant. We can give them more cells. Whereas before, if we killed them, sorry, let's try to get you through to your body and try to stimulate your body to make its own, to repair itself. Well, now with stem cell transplant, we can actually help them along, some of these patients. Okay. Just like anything, cancer cells can develop resistance to various meds and treatments. And we talk about AIDS next, HIV and AIDS. We should hopefully at this point, you guys know a lot about drug resistance. With those medications, this isn't any different with these either. And so if drug resistance has developed, if we get rid of those old cells, or we can, hopefully the drugs themselves can be more effective. The procedure itself has many risks, and including death, can be highly toxic. Overall, the cure rates are still low but increasing. We're getting better and better with stem cell, what they need, how it's differentiating in the body, understanding how the body is reacting to the new stem cells, how effective they are. So again, it is increasing. And for some, if this is your only option for survival or gives you the best percentage or chance for survival, even though the risks are high, it's worth it for them to take those risks. Okay, tumor cells are eradicated and bone marrow is rescued by infusing healthy cells. So that's basically what it is doing there. It can be categorized as allogenic, syngenic, or autologous. Allogenic means what? Does anybody have a guess? Pardon me? Can be. We can become allergic to it more easily because it's a volunteer donor. Okay? So it's allogenic means it's a volunteer person, a random person is donating their bone marrow because of the graciousness they have in their heart. Okay? Syngenic means it's an identical twin donation. And autologous, own cells, their own self. Oh. Okay. Syngenic is more of the family member, identical twin, identical matches. Autologous is self. So they'll take some of the cells, maybe they had knew they had it and they had banked some. A lot of times too, on the next slide, I'll show you why. On the next slide, I'll talk about that, how they can do that, how they can get their own cells out.
So is syngenic family member or just identical twin?
Mostly they see with identical twin because they're going to be the best match. They will check the rest of the family members though. Okay, sources of stem cells include bone marrow, peripheral blood, and umbilical cord blood. This picture is also in your textbook. So basically, when they have a patient who is going to be using stem cells, especially their own, they'll harvest some of their bone marrow, and then they're going to treat what they have, the bone marrow cells that they got, that can destroy the malignant cells without harming the normal cells. It's easier to do in a tube because you don't have systemic side effects, right, throughout the body. So they're going to take that and get those personal stem cells ready to be infused back into the patient. The patient then, after those, some of their stem cells have been removed, they're going to get hit with high doses of the chemotherapy radiation that they need to kill the rest of the cancer cells within the body. And then they're going to be injected with the purified stem cells to hopefully then regenerate and help that body recover from the high doses of chemo that they got. It's kind of cool how they can do that anymore. Yes.
Does it ever happen where they destroy the normal cells, like on accident?
Oh, I'm sure it probably is. Probably. I'm sure that probably has happened. With anything, with radiation and with chemo, we'll find out that although they are specific, we're trying to kill just the abnormal cells, good cells are going to get destroyed as well. Yeah. We're just hoping to decrease the number of good ones that get destroyed. Yeah.
Does this kind, because it's the same cells, the same patient, work better than the other types of, other types of transplants?
It all depends. This is highly toxic, though, because remember, we're taking some out of the patient, even some of the good ones that are there, and then we're hitting them with a high dose of chemo. And so patients may or may not survive that dose of chemo if we don't get those other cells back into them in a sufficient amount of time. So it's still varied. There's not real good statistics yet because it's new enough, but that's one of the risks we just have to explain to the patients that we're going to be doing that. All right, the next slide talks about three methods of harvesting stem cells. We can get it from the bone marrow, and we've talked about that procedure already. It can be obtained from peripheral blood. And I'll talk about each of these more in the next slides. And umbilical cord blood is also very rich in hematopoietic cells. It can be stored and used later. Now, our local area hospitals do not do this. I'm not sure if Mercy has a bank. Do you know if they have a bank?
We have a growing genetic, yeah.
Bank.
Whole section, yeah.
Okay. So they need to go to a large Sioux Falls or Sioux City to have their actual, it's stored and banked. But it is growing. And they can do the procedures here, but they just can't store them locally. All right, if they're getting it from the bone marrow, it's procedure generally done in the OR or under anesthesia. They may not necessarily take them to the OR anymore. They'll just can do them in the room. They may do multiple aspirations with into the bone marrow itself to get an adequate number of stem cells, usually from the iliac crest, okay, which is here in the hip. Okay, that's where they'll go in, or sometimes from the sternum. They're numbed.
Okay, remember.
Yeah, but how long?
Yeah. It will hurt. All right, the marrow is processed. Okay, to remove any bone fragments once it is removed. And then the cells are cryopreserved until they're reinfused back in. With peripheral blood, this is an outpatient procedure. There's a cell separator equipment. It sorts the stem cells out, and then it returns your other cells back into the donor. It takes generally about 2 to 4 hours, but you don't collect a whole lot. Again, and they're more mature. So there is a function for them, and they're becoming more and more useful. But it's a process. It's not a quick thing to do. Cord blood, it can be HLA typed and cryopreserved. Again, may have insufficient number of stem cells to actually permit transplant into adults. But it's something. It's a starting point anyway for those who need the stem cells. Complications that we may see. Bacterial, viral, and fungal infections are common. That should make sense to us. If we've taken out some of their good working bone marrow, they're going to be at risk for infection to set in. So they'll generally start them on some prophylactic antibiotics. Because this is tissue, it's like a transplant, tissue transplant, we have to talk about graft versus host disease. The T lymphocytes actually can recognize the recipient as foreign, and it can attack it, just like if it was a new liver or a new organ. So we have to watch for transplant rejection signs. Attacks organs such as the skin, liver, and GI tract. So how would we tell if it was doing that? How would we know if it was actually attacking these areas?
Say it
louder. They would start to fail. Okay, we'd start to see necrotic areas break down on the skin, liver. How would we know if the liver is not failing or if the liver is failing?
Jaundice,
AST, ALT, our liver function test, right? Okay, GI tract, how do we know if that's failing? Pardon me?
Like a paralytic.
Ileus, okay? Are they gonna be passing gas? Are they gonna have normal bowel movements? Okay, are they gonna have anorexia? Okay, all of those things. Our last slide. Peripheral stem cells cause fewer and less severe complications because they are more mature. But again, there are fewer of them, so it takes more of them. But this is a newer treatment, and you'll read more and I'm sure see more and more about that as well. Any questions about that? This PowerPoint, yes?
So, is it you put in the bone marrow transplant or stem cells and take out, or where to transplant it?
To transplant the cells, it depends where they're going to be going. They can be infused right into the blood. Yes. Or they can go right back into the bone marrow. There's depending on where they're needing them. Because stem, what are stem cells? Say it louder. You're right. Right. So wherever they're needed, whatever type of cell they need to become.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, very good. All right. Kathy, do you need a
bathroom?
Yes.
All right.